Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 315. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send an email on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is, of course, This Show Is So Gay. And if you have a second, stroll on over to the Facebook. Type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have such a fun show for you this week. We must get started with our guest. Ben Rimmelauer is the author and star of the long-running, critically acclaimed smash hit solo play Patty Issues. So many different awards. It won a Mac Award. It won a Bistro Award. It was featured in the Adelaide Cabaret Festival and the Eugene O'Neill Theatre Center Summer Conference. He did a PSA with Alan Cumming and Patti LuPone. It was a homepage selection on Funny or Die. We love that Funny or Die. He's written for Playbill. He's written for the Huffington Post. He's directed and produced just a ton of plays. I cannot list them all, but some of them, Joy, The Fabulous Life of a Size Zero, Project Lohan, so many more. The Advocate magazine called him, and we're going to talk about this, Ben, they called him the Midas of Cabaret. He has helmed just a slew of solo shows for artists including Alec Mappa, Cola Scola, Our Lady J, we love Our Lady J, and our bestest friend of all of our friends, the beloved Kate Pizzakis. As a performer, he's been on Bravo TV's Watch What Happens Live, ABC's Extreme Makeover, tons and tons more. He just finished an incredible run of his work, Bad With Money and Patty Issues, at our beloved Duplex, my home away from home. Now he is here with us. Ben, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you. What an introduction.
I left out so much, Ben, because we would have no time to talk to you.
It felt very complete.
Yes. Okay, good. That's good. Now, this is a little bit tricky, Ben. You're a little bit of a tricky guest 315 episodes later because you do so many different things. Is there a particular label that you gravitate towards more than all the others? Author or producer or director? Or is there something that catches you more than the others?
I mean, the way I identify myself nowadays is as a writer-performer. If I had to choose just one thing, I guess it would be writer.
Okay.
But performing feels connected to that. You know, I don't necessarily think of myself as an actor, but a lot of the work that I want to create is stuff that I would want to perform. And directing is still something I'm very interested in, although it doesn't seem to be what I'm most excited to do at the moment. And I've always been a producer only for the sake of seeing my own work produced. So,
nice.
You know, I'll continue to do that until people come along and are willing to, you know, produce my work for me. Although then I'm sure I'll have a lot of problems with how they produce it. And I'll probably look back on the good old days when I was producing it myself. Yeah, that's basically my answer.
Do you think there's a narrative thread that connects all Ben Rimmelauer productions?
Yeah, Patty LuPone.
There you go. That was as easy as that.
Not entirely, but... But, you know, I think it's really a lot of stuff that has just, I think in a way, Patty Issues was sort of my sort of life thesis or something. Because, you know, the way that my love of Patti LuPone and more generally speaking, my love of musical theater sort of inspired me in my, not so much coming out of the closet, but just sort of like growing up as a gay man, you know, as a human being, I think that those things have sort of been a part of all the work that I've gravitated toward over the years.
I saw one article called you a Patti LuPone savant. That's quite a title.
I think I made that up.
All right, we'll go with that. I feel like, is there even a better time to be talking about Patti LuPone than right now?
I mean, you know, if you ask me one moment, Patti LuPone is as wonderful as the next. But yeah, it's pretty awesome how much attention she's getting.
I can't imagine that we have listeners across the country to This Show Is So Gay who don't have a Patti LuPone appreciation. I mean, I feel like it's right there in the title of our show. But if there was a listener out there who's like, yeah, I just, this Patti LuPone, I kind of know her, I don't have the appreciation, how would you sell Patti LuPone to a listening audience?
Sure. Well, I would say she's a Broadway star. She's, if you know, arguably the biggest Broadway star of the last, you know, 30 or 40 years, that she was the original Broadway Evita. And she was also the original star of Les Miserables, and that she was on the TV show Life Goes On as Corky's mother. And that she's gotten a lot of press for these sort of incidents recently, like this thing where she she grabbed the cell phone out of someone's hand in the audience of a play she's in where they were texting, in character, of course. And a few years ago when she was on Broadway in Gypsy, when she stopped the show to berate an audience member who was taking photos, which became a big, you know, viral video with the remix and everything. And that part of that is the dramatic edge of Patty's fiery Sicilian personality, which made her so great in so many fiery roles like Evita and Mrs. Lovett and Sweeney Todd and Gypsy, et cetera, et cetera. And that, you know, she's sort of the ultimate diva, that she's got, you know, that's why she's gotten attention for these things, because it's what's exciting about her and what's fabulous and powerful.
Now, we approach Patty in completely different ways, Ben. I will be very upfront with you. Some of my appreciation for her is a little bit fear-based. I'm a little scared of Patty LuPone. Like, she could...
Mine, too. I mean, I think that's everyone. I think that to love Patty is to fear her. I mean, you know, in my show Patty Issues, I talk about how John Houseman, who is, you know, one of the greatest Shakespearean actors of the 20th century and was Patty's teacher at Juilliard and then the head of the acting company where she got her career started in repertory theater in the 70s, famous to people of my generation because he played Ricky Schroeder's grandfather on Silver Spoon.
Yes, he did.
But John Houseman said of Patty that she has the smell of the gallows. And people always get that wrong, and they say that he said she had, like, the smell of the footlights or, you know, the grease paint or whatever. But he said gallows, and he didn't say she has the gallows humor. He said that she has the smell of the gallows. I mean, that's death, crime and punishment, you know. And that's Patty. She's out for blood. You know, when Patty is, that's why she's so effective as the cannibalistic meat pie cooker, you know, or the mother who essentially cannibalizes her children, or the you know, the fascist dictator. I mean, you know, there's she is to be feared. She has a fierceness, you know, and not just in a snap, 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 fierce, mama, yes, bitch way, but like she will cut you.
Yeah.
She'll bite your head off.
Why do the gays love Patty?
Well, I think, you know, there's the whole thing about why do the gays love musical theater and right. Why do we love Judy Garland and all that, you know, so I think some of it is just very much along those lines, you know. But I think with Patty in particular, there's this, at least for me, you know, I felt unempowered as a child, you know. I was growing up gay, which was not cool
right. In
the 1980s. And I had a very dramatic family life where I felt really scared of, like, my crazy father and the stuff he was doing. I mean, that's what my show is about, what Patty's Shoes is about. And Patty LuPone was this monster, but she was, like, my dragon. You know, I felt I would listen to Evita, and I wouldn't feel scared of her like she was going to hurt me. I would identify with her and feel like I was powerful vicariously through her.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, I think a lot of us can sort of, like, see Patty as like a sort of conduit for our own empowerment, you know, and she's a powerful female figure. You know, I could have watched, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger movies, but I didn't relate to that, you know,
right.
And I had no interest in being a big, strong man, you know. Unfortunately, I wish I would have put in some time at the gym. I would have done better in my adult sex life, but, you know, but I wanted to be like a fiery, tempestuous diva.
Yeah.
And Patty is that, you know, in the greatest way, with a sense of humor, and of course that just like killer voice, you know, so I think that's her appeal.
I love it. Now, we should be very clear with folks, you have met Patty. How did you work your way through meeting her to actually function?
Well, that's what my show Patty Issues is about in a large sense. I've been obsessed with her, you know, for decades, and my first professional job in the theater in New York was as an assistant director on the New York Philharmonic's production of Sweeney Todd at Avery Fisher Hall in the year 2000. And it was terrifying. You know, I tried to play it cool because
right.
I didn't want to be inappropriate, you know, and the truth is I was the assistant director. This was a rushed rehearsal process for a concert version. So there was a lot of people that Patty was meeting in the room for the first time, and we were working very quickly. So I think that gave me kind of a cover of anonymity. I mean, I was Ben. I was Lonnie's assistant. I was clearly gay and clearly, like, thought she was fabulous. But she didn't really understand the extent of, like, the posters hanging in my apartment or, like, you know, all that. So I think that I was able to sort of just hide under that cover. But then the more time I spent with her, I worked on several other shows as an assistant director that she was in. We actually started to develop a relationship, and it was hard for me to cover. It just came out how much I loved her. I mean, I tell a story in Patty's Juice that one time we were in rehearsals and she said, "Can someone bring me a glass of water?" And I jumped up from my seat and said, "Yes, Divina." You know, it was like not within the realm of normal, like, rehearsal talk. But, you know, part of the great thing about Patty is that she loves that, you know. Patty's not scared of that because Patty's confident in her own ability to be like, back off if you're bugging her,
right.
You know. So she doesn't have to be afraid of what other people do. And she loves people that, you know, worship her because, you know, she likes being treated that way.
What does it mean for you to get on stage and present Patty Issues to so many different audiences? What do you get out of it, Ben?
Well, a lot of things. I mean, it's cathartic and empowering for me to talk about, you know, all these sort of arcs, these sort of journeys in my life, including all the stuff with Patty, you know, which is not always hunky-dory. I mean, we have a beautiful relationship now, and we have for many years, but there were some trying times. And then particularly with my father, where there was so much drama. To be in a position with both of those situations where I feel really evolved, and I feel like I have a lot of wisdom and experience, and I feel proud of how I've navigated them, and I feel good about where I am in those situations now. So that allows me to tell the stories to the audience with the richness of what those experiences were, including being able to laugh at myself or, you know, laugh at the other people in the stories that were colorful characters, you know, and I enjoy having an audience come on that journey and, you know, seeing them appreciate all the funny things that happened and hopefully moving them with, you know, the sort of, you know, just the humanity of the experience.
I would imagine that you have gotten just some incredible feedback from audiences.
Yeah, some wonderful, 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 you know, I mean, that's why I do it. I love that interaction.
I get to take a step back with you, and this is not something that we often get to do on this show, and it kills me that we don't get to talk about it more, but as I said in your intro, The Advocate calling you the Midas of cabaret, you have an appreciation for the cabaret scene, which I sometimes struggle to explain to folks on this show. You know, I'm one of those fortunate ones where I grew up in New York City, you know, and I went to school there, and that was such a huge part of my life, that cabaret scene. And it's something that a lot of our listeners across the country just don't get to experience. How would you describe the cabaret scene to our listening audience?
Well, it's in flux right now. There was the traditional idea of cabaret, you know, was in the old days when you know, musical theater songs, the Great American Songbook, Rodgers and Hammerstein and Cole Porter and, you know, Irving Berlin, whatever. Those were the songs that were on the radio.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't rock singers who wrote their own material. It was these songs mostly from musicals or written by people that did write musicals. And there were singers, whether it was Rosemary Clooney or Ella Fitzgerald or Frank Sinatra or Bobby Darin or whoever, singing them. And you could go to New York to a club and you could see, you know, maybe a sort of second tier of people. Maybe sometimes it would be Rosemary Clooney, but it would be the Julie Wilsons and the Frances Fays and all these sort of like sophisticated people in these supper clubs, you know, a lot of them in these fancy hotels in the Waldorf or the Plaza. And they would have dinner and be dressed up and there'd be a band and they would sing these songs. And that's how people heard music. There was no MTV, you know, and even concerts, they weren't the sort of like stadium industry that they are today. You know, I mean, if Frank Sinatra did a concert, he wasn't like on a circuit the way like, you know, Maroon 5 would be.
Right.
And, you know, and that wasn't just in New York. I mean, it was in all the cities. You know, I mean, St. Louis was famous for the spin clubs it had in Los Angeles and Chicago. And, you know, wherever people were, there was that kind of music available. And that started to change, you know, after the rock and roll revolution. And this sort of modern idea of cabaret kind of came up in New York in the 70s and 80s and 90s, where, you know, it was very separate from what was sort of the popular music. And it was these sort of people that were only sort of known within the circles of cabaret fans or maybe some musical theater. And that's kind of when Barbara Cook took off, you know, and then Nancy Lamott was one of the great stars, and she and Laurie Beachman both, unfortunately, who were so beloved in that field, both died of cancer in the 90s. But that became its own thing, and so it was some of that Great American Songbook, and then it was also some of the sort of like post-rock and roll stuff, because a lot of the people that were singing these songs had grown up listening to Joni Mitchell and Bob Dylan and Paul Simon and the Beatles, and so they were incorporating that kind of music into the sort of new Great American Songbook. And then there were people that wrote for cabaret, so there was a whole sort of new genre that evolved in that too. And that has become more localized in New York as it's the great supper clubs have disappeared. And so cabarets are just kind of like these piano bars where maybe there's a showroom and, you know, there's a 2-drink minimum, but generally there's not food. And it's that's struggling to survive in New York, but it's really disappeared in a lot of the other cities. Although the way that I fell in love with it was not in New York. It was when I was in college at Berkeley in the San Francisco Bay Area. There was a club in San Francisco, which is no longer there, called the Plush Room, although the people that owned it and ran it have another venue now called Live at the Raz. But I would go there, and, you know, some of the cabaret singers you might see in New York would come out and do shows there, but there was one based in the Bay Area named Meg McKay that I absolutely fell in love with, and you know, I listen to her albums to this day all the time, and I long, which is very rare that she performs in New York, but I live for it. And, you know, to me, she was my cabaret singer. There's so many of those great American Songbook songs, I think of her version as the version, you know.
Nice.
And I think that's part of what's wonderful about cabaret is that it's a, you know, it is this live experience that the audience's experience of the songs is, it's right there in the moment. It's not, oh, you know, well, the Beatles sang Michelle, so, you know, that's the version, you know. But maybe the way that you know it had to be you is because you saw Meg McKay sing it at the Plush Room, and
right.
That's the version that means the most, you know, to you. And that part of what's been wonderful for me about working in cabaret as much as I have in the last 10 years in New York is that I think in the age of the internet and everything else, theater struggles to have relevance. Because, you know, why should I go watch a play in an uncomfortable seat and spend a lot of money when I could turn on Showtime and HBO and AMC and see some of the greatest acting, some of it by theater actors,
yeah.
And fantastic writing. And, you know, so I think theater has to find a reason to exist beyond just a good story, which you could see somewhere else. And, you know, that's why we've seen a lot of these sort of self-referential things. You know, they're trying to make the use of breaking the fourth wall, finding all these different ways to be theatrical in a way that movies and TV cannot be. And I think with cabaret, that's automatic. Even the worst cabaret act is already dealing with that issue because the audience is the second character. I mean, you have to talk to the audience. There is no fourth wall in cabaret.
Right.
I think that makes it very immediate and very relevant and, you know, and it has the potential to be very exciting.
I mean, sometimes the audience is just right there. They're the distance between the performer and the audience. It's
totally.
It's quite crazy. It's quite crazy. You have to sing the praises for a second of my beloved Duplex. I mean, I think there was no greater place that I've ever gotten fired from than the Duplex.
You were fired from the Duplex?
Quite proud of it, yes.
Oh, my God. Can we talk about it?
It was a mess. I wasn't as good as everybody else. No, I, you know, it was great. It was a great place where I started doing comedy back in the late 90s when I was an undergrad at NYU and was working at the Duplex. And that's how, you know, it was basically just suddenly Seymour with Kate Pizakis 5 nights a week. It was great. But I was doing more of the funny stuff and I just was not as good of a singer as everybody else. And it didn't work out for me in the Duplex.
But I've been very lucky, you know, saying if it weren't for the Duplex, I wouldn't have had nearly this success that I have with my shows. And I'm really grateful for it.
I love it. I love it. Well, I have all of this random kind of Ben Rimmelauer ephemera. Can we jump around a little bit?
Yeah, please.
First, I read a piece that you wrote for Decider.com about Little Shop of Horrors. Nothing could have made me happier to read. It was.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear that.
I loved it. Now, am I correct in saying that you did just see Ellen Green do Audrey again?
Yes.
Tell me, because I wasn't there. I'm here in Cleveland, Ben. I'm relying on you to tell our listening audience what that experience was like.
It was religious.
Yay.
You know, to say that she has not changed at all physically or vocally sounds like hyperbole.
Okay.
And it is not hyperbole. And also, it's actually beside the point because as much the same as she was so present and so in the moment, and it happened in real time in front of us, you know. It was something extremely powerful. And it was, you know, talk about the experience of the live audience. I mean, the closest thing that I've seen to this experience was when I saw City Center Encore's Pal Joey in 1995. And it was Patti LuPone's first performance in New York after being fired from Sunset Boulevard. And it was this intense love fest of the energy between Patti and the audience, from our entrance applause to the way we as the audience were just with her every single line, holding our breath, you know. And that's what it was like with Ellen Green. It was that kind of a homecoming. You know, it was just really beautiful, and it was brilliant. It was a kind of, I think I've always known that there was a lot more to her Audrey than just being funny and quirky and cute and, you know, whatever, but it all made so much sense. You know, you can sort of make fun of that weird voice she has, the way she goes from the squeaky baby voice to the, like, bizarre, like, mezzo-soprano, yes, like, floating head voice to the, like, insane, like, rocking out, like, mannerisms. You know, it all, like, it sort of works, but you kind of don't know why. But watching it a couple weeks ago, watching her do it live, I did know why. It worked so this was a woman. This was a human being. This was like, you know, all those disjointed things didn't feel disjointed. They felt like, you know, all integral to who this woman is. And it made sense, the vulnerability and the strength and the little girlness and the passion and the anger. And, you know, it just all was there and so tied together beautifully.
And for our listeners, I mean, it's over, so we can't go see her now in that. So
yeah,
for both me and our listeners, you have this great appreciation and you write all about it. And really, it's a lovely piece on the movie, on Little Shop of Horrors. You say in that piece, Ellen Green's Audrey is one of the great musical theater performances of her generation, up there with Patti LuPone in Evita and Jennifer Holliday in Dreamgirls. That's pretty high praise right there. I love it.
No question. I mean, I've actually always felt that way, and this only made me feel it, you know, so much more. But it absolutely is. You know, it's bizarre how these careers work. I mean, with Ellen Green, it's this strange thing. On one hand, she got to do the movie of Little Shop.
Right.
You know, Patti did not get to do that with Evita. Jennifer Holliday did not get to do that with Dreamgirls. And, you know, so in a way, she more got the sort of Streisand ticket to Hollywood from New York than the other girls did, and certainly than Betty Buckley did, you know?
Right.
You know, and even Bernadette, she didn't get to do the movie of Into the Woods, you know, but at the same time, Ellen Green has never had another show, and even Little Shop, as wonderful as it was that it stayed off Broadway, she never even, I mean, she did do other shows on Broadway, but she never got to do Little Shop on Broadway. You know, where was the Tony Award that she deserved for that?
Right.
So it's like, it's such a strange career that she's had, and yet, despite how weird it is, and even, you know, she has had these weird Hollywood roles, just when you think she's completely through, she'll do Pushing Daisies,
right,
you know, and be wonderful. I mean, she's really, there's no one like her, and there's no one like her, and there's no career like hers.
So interesting. I remember seeing her years ago in, gosh, it was a Broadway Divas Christmas, I think it was called.
Oh, God, yeah.
And
that train wreck on the left side, yeah. It's like Marla Shaw. Kate Bazakis was in that.
Yes. I think that's why I saw it. I think Kate said, you have to come. And so I went, and I remember Ellen Green singing Silent Night in German. And it was a little scary, but it was still Ellen Green singing Silent Night in German. So it was fun.
Totally.
I love it.
Yeah, I mean, that probably wasn't the greatest. I mean, that's the only time I'd seen her live. No, you know what? I'd also seen her do her concert at the Bottom Line. Of that album she did, In His Eyes, you know, in the 2000s. Anyway, you know, she's just amazing.
I love it. See, some of our listeners are going to be like, I don't know who these two guys are talking about at all. And I think that's this piece of, you know, that's why I love that you wrote about the movie, because anybody can go watch the movie. But that's what I get nervous sometimes about, talking about cabaret and talking about Broadway, you know, in this way that our listeners across the country can't access it, you know? More work to be
it's
done.
It's too bad, because, I mean, Little Shop really, you know, it should be such a part of people's, you know, across the country, across the world. It should be a part of people's pop culture experience.
Oh, There you go. She's one of those that if I actually met her, I just feel like I grew up on that one. That was the movie
Totally.
musical that I grew up on.
Totally.
So there's that. You have all of this other writing out there that's so fun. I have to tell you, one of my favorite pieces that you've written for the Huffington Post, you have a piece called, and it was, I know it was a few years ago, but I feel like it's still fresh in your mind, called It's Scary as Hell to Sing Show Tunes Sober. I love that piece, Ben.
Oh, thank you. Oh
It's
my God, that was a while ago.
it was I go back, I do my research. It's super sweet. It's just I it's so resonated with, and I'm gonna link to it for folks. It's again, folks, it's called It's Scary as Hell to Sing Show Tunes Sober, and you will read it, listeners, and you'll be like, oh yeah, totally had that moment, and I agree. Now, you just wrapped up presenting there at the Duplex. You just did Bad with Money, you just did Patty Issues. What's coming up for you, my friend?
Well, I'm in the process of securing an option on a children's book that a couple of friends and I of mine and I are going to make a musical out of.
Nice.
I can't say the title,
Okay.
but it's a popular children's book from the 1970s. I've got a few other things like that. You know, I'll probably do another solo play. I have some things in mind too, but I'm not going to do that right away. So it's been a lot of writing stuff. You know, I've got my Playbill column every week and my Decider column, and I'm supposed to be writing things for New Now Next, although I haven't been good about getting the pitches in every day like I'm supposed to. But I love doing that kind of writing, like sort of personal essay style. And I want to write a memoir based on my shows. So I'm getting ready for that. You know, who knows what the future holds.
Is there a Ben Remmelauer writing process? Is there a place that you like to sit and write where the juices are just flowing?
I like to sit at my desk in my apartment looking out the window. I like to sort of vomit up. And then, you know, when I sort of feel like I'm done vomiting, I'll do stuff. Speaking of singing sober, I'll like sing karaoke in my apartment. That kind of gets me like creative juices flowing. I love to walk around my neighborhood. If I listen to, I listen to a lot of Rufus Wainwright and Sandra Bernhard. Rufus Wainwright, I think because he's about my age and I've been listening to his stuff and relating to his stuff since I was, you know, 23 and moving to New York. So walking around my neighborhood in Brooklyn where I've lived all these 16 years, listening to his music, all his albums, it takes me back to all these experiences of my life and sort of makes them feel very connected, the past and the present. And Sandra Bernhard, because I love her style of monologues. And when I listen to her and I'm so fascinated by the things she has to say, it sort of makes me feel like I'm in the conversation and like I have things to say. So if I walk around my neighborhood and I listen to Rufus or I listen to Sandra, then I go back to my apartment, I'm usually ready to sit down and write more.
Nice, nice. And we will conclude with our little Learning Annex segment with Ben Remmelauer. For our listeners out there who are thinking, you know, I got that one man show in my head and I just can't seem to get it out there. What's that one piece of advice that's going to help them?
Just write it.
There you go.
You know, like set a date to do a reading for your close friends, and that's your deadline, and you've got to do it. And don't worry about is it good? Because you're just doing it for your friends. You can either make it better later or you can decide not to do more with it. You know, and don't worry about, do I really want to put this story out there? Because you're just doing it for your friends. You know, it's not like someone's going to take it out of your hands and without your permission put it up on Broadway. You know, you're going to have control every step of the way, so you don't have to be afraid. You know, just experiment and do what you can. And, you know, even if you decide, you know what, that was a good learning experience, but I don't want to do that show, you'll feel so much more confident and ready to do another thing because you got that out of your system, you know? And that's the most important thing. I mean, you know, there's a million writers out there, and some of them are good and some of them are bad, and that's subjective. And some of them are successful and some of them are not successful, and the successful ones might not be the ones that are good. So you don't know how good or bad you are, and you don't know how successful you're going to be. But the difference between your best work and your worst work is much smaller than the difference between no work at all and something you can do, you know?
I love it. I love it. All right, listeners, this is what you need to do. First of all, stroll on over to benrimmelauer.com. You got all this information about him there. You can read up on Bad With Money. You can read about Patty issues. You can see videos. It's all going down on benrimmelauer.com. And I must encourage you to click on that little Twitter button right there at the top, because he's got some pretty funny tweets. You entertain me with your tweets, Ben.
Thank you.
Good stuff out there. You, my friend, are the very definition of what we talk about week in, week out. You are using your voice in your own unique way to make a difference out there, to get folks talking and to entertain. It's such a great treat to have you on the show, Ben.
Oh, thank you. I had such a good time talking to you.
Shades of night are falling and I'm lonely, standing on a corner feeling. Sweethearts out for fun, pass me one by one. Guess I'll wind up like I always do, with only me and my shadow, strolling down the
folks, and we are back. Well, we have so much time on this week's episode to cover all the latest LGBT news out there. I will pause for a second and remind you that if you have any guest ideas, if there's someone you would like to see on This Show Is So Gay, send us their info. Just drop a line over to ken@thisshowisogay.com. Maybe it's someone local who's doing something super cool in your community that more folks should know about, or maybe it's some reach guest. I love when you guys send me someone. I'm like, yeah, okay. Okay, I'll try to get them, and every now and then it happens, so it works out. Whoever's on your mind, we love featuring voices of folks who are making a difference, who are using their own voices to lift up other LGBT and ally voices. So send over that name that you are thinking of right this very second. Send it on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com. Onto the news. The huge news this week was all about the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And some folks are calling this just as big as marriage equality. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, EEOC, they ruled just last week that existing civil rights law bars sexual orientation-based employment discrimination, which is a groundbreaking decision to advance legal protections for gay, lesbian, and bisexual workers. The commission concluded in a decision that was dated July 15th, it said this, quote, "Allegations of discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation necessarily state a claim of discrimination on the basis of sex." And so they were addressing the question of whether the ban on sex discrimination in Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, they were trying to figure out if that bars anti-LGB, lesbian, gay, bisexual discrimination, in a complaint that was brought forward by a Florida-based air traffic control specialist against Transportation Secretary Anthony Fox. So the ruling, which was approved by a 3-2 vote of the five-person commission, It was very close, but the ruling applies to federal employees' claims directly, but it also applies to the entire EEOC, which includes its offices across the nation that take and investigate claims of discrimination in private employment. So any of you who have ever applied for a job ever have probably seen the EEOC. They're part of all of these processes. So only the Supreme Court can issue a definitive ruling on this interpretation, even though that is the only route that can totally codify this into law. EEOC decisions are given significant deference by federal courts. So this is huge, a huge change in employment law. Now, Tico Almeida, who is the head of Freedom to Work, he celebrated the decision and he urged LGBT groups to go to the courts to seek codification of the ruling. He said this, quote, "Freedom to Work applauds this historic decision by the EEOC, and we encourage gay men, lesbians, and bisexuals who face harassment or discrimination on the job to consult an attorney and file Title VII claims with the EEOC and eventually the federal courts. Our LGBT movement should take this strongly reasoned legal victory and run with it by returning to the federal courts to win workplace protection in all 50 states." I want to pause right there for a second, because what you heard earlier in the article, and I stole this one from BuzzFeed, was a lot about lesbian, gay, bisexual. And that's the clarification we want to make with this, that not everyone is talking about. Some articles are highlighting it, but right there in Tico Almeida, the head of Freedom to Work's quote, he mentioned LGBT, and we need to be very clear here and say that we are talking about sexual orientation here as a protected identity. We are not talking about gender identity or gender expression. Gender identity and gender expression, that more commonly applies to individuals who are in that T category, who identify as transgender. So we need to be really careful here and not just fold in the whole community, because for our transgender brothers and sisters, well, sexual orientation is not really the issue of why they are facing workplace harassment and where they are not protected. That's not the issue. It's not with sexual orientation. It's with gender identity or gender expression or a combination of the two. So let's be very careful here in not just lumping everyone together, because they were dealing with different things. I'll just end with this quote from Chad Griffin, the president of the Human Rights Campaign. He said this, quote, "This historic ruling by the EEOC makes clear they agree workplace discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, much like gender identity, is illegal. While an important step, it also highlights the need for a comprehensive federal law permanently and clearly banning LGBT discrimination beyond employment to all areas of American life. Such a law would send a clear and permanent signal that discrimination against LGBT people will not be tolerated under any circumstances in this country, and we remain fully committed to making that happen," end quote. So that was a really big deal, because some folks were misinterpreting this and just saying, oh, well, gosh, we don't need the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. We don't need to push for that in Congress right now, something that has been failing for years and years and years to get passed. And that's not true. This decision by the EEOC is not codified into law. It has to be challenged, or a new law actually needs to be written that specifically bans LGBT discrimination in the workplace. So folks who are letting up their guard and just saying, oh gosh, well, we now have ENDA. We do not have an Employment Non-Discrimination Act. That is something we still desperately need. Yes, again, for the 8,000th time, I know I'm like a broken record on the show talking about it, but yes, marriage equality is a great thing, but I could get married to my boyfriend tomorrow and I will let you know if he proposes. I don't know. But if he proposes and I say yes, I'll probably say yes. If that indeed happens and we get married tomorrow, the next day when I come into work, if I put a picture of him on my desk, I could be fired. There are more protections that we need, more protectors that we need. So that's in the employment discrimination front. Over in Kentucky, this was a really nutty story. Rowan County's clerk, she prayed and fasted over her decision to refuse marriage licenses for same-sex couples. She said this as she was testifying in federal court, and she believes that she is upholding her oath under the Constitution. Clerk Kim Davis's refusal to provide licenses has drawn wide attention after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled last month that marriage is a fundamental right for all couples. Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear ordered clerks to comply with the decision. Well, Clerk Kim Davis, this was her quote, "It wasn't just a spur-of-the-moment decision. It was thought out, and I sought God on it." On the stand this week, Clerk Davis said she believes marriage is defined as the union of one man and one woman under the Bible, which is God's holy word, that's her quote, and she said she contemplated her policy for months. She choked back tears as she argued that issuing licenses under her name would violate her religious beliefs, even if a deputy clerk performs the task in her stead. She said this, quote, "If I say they are authorized, I'm saying I agree with it, and I can't." So I'm going to pause right here and say, that's totally fine, Kim Davis. You do not have to issue marriage licenses. All that means now is that you need to resign your position. So I'm not looking to take away anyone's religious liberties. That's one of those crazy fallacy arguments that's out there that, oh gosh, if you do this, right, if you tell people that they have to agree with marriage equality, they are being denied their religious liberties. No, that's totally fine. I want people to stand up and say, I don't believe in marriage equality. This goes against everything I believe in. That is absolutely everybody's right to say. That's fine. It just means that there are certain jobs that you can't do. You can't take a government position. You know that crazy piece where we separate church from state. You can believe everything you want to believe, but you still have to sign marriage licenses. You have to issue them. And if you feel that that interferes with your ability to do it, totally cool. You just have to resign. That's all. It's totally fine. I'm not even being sarcastic, by the way. I'm not being snarky. I'm not being jaded or bitter. It's totally fine. I want everyone to have their religious liberties. It just means there are certain roles that you now can't perform. And I believe the same thing, right? So there were jobs when I was first on the job market that said, if you take this job, you need to understand that to work for this faith-based college, you cannot tell students that being gay is okay. You cannot say that in your role. I think at the time it was for a hall director. Now, they weren't trying to take away my liberties. They were just trying to say, if you take this job, you can't say this. And indeed, that was going to be compromising my ability to do that job. And that was compromising who I was. And so I didn't take that job. That's totally fine. You get to have your religious liberties. It just means there are certain jobs that you can't take. That's all. Totally fine. I stand up and defend your religious liberties, but if you're in a government position, I'm sorry, you actually do need to put that aside because it's interfering with your job, the one that you swore to protect. That's all. There you go. Hey, something you might not hear about. In Alabama, I love stories like this because they don't make mainstream news. I get them from friends of mine who are in certain states who are posting them, and you would never hear about them. People in the LGBT community now have a new place to go to meet their mental health needs. This week, the University of Alabama at Birmingham, they opened up a new mental health and wellness clinic specifically for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer and questioning individuals. LGBT youth are at increased risk for suicidal thoughts and behaviors, suicide attempts and suicide, bullying, substance use, drug use, and feelings of depression, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Adult and adolescent patients will be seen by Larry McMillan, who trained and did a two-year fellowship in psychiatry at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. He said this, quote, "Many members of the LGBTQ community are not inclined to seek professional help when they are in need due to fears of being marginalized or stigmatized. We want to knock down those barriers to care so that the new clinic is a welcoming environment where those who identify as LGBTQ will feel comfortable enough to seek assistance for their mental health needs." And the clinic will operate on Mondays. It's located in the, I'll even give you this information, it's located in the Department of Psychiatry on the third floor of the Callahan Eye Hospital building. The address is 1720 University Boulevard. I love it. I love it. I'm going to even give you more. Patients should call 205-934-7008, option number 2, to make an appointment. Why am I providing this specific information? Because there are so many barriers to LGBTQ folks seeking either mental health assistance, physical health assistance, whatever it might be. They are nervous to go to a doctor because they're not sure what kind of care they are going to receive. So anytime a clinic opens up that's doing this great work, we want to highlight that. If that's happening in your community, let us know and we'll advertise that too. Free advertising here on this show is so gay because we want to get people help that they need that maybe because they're feeling stigmatized or nervous or whatever it might be, there are barriers to them getting that help. So we want to help out in that way as well. Kudos to you, everybody, over at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Fantastic, fantastic. And there was, I mean, we're pairing this with, there was a study, there's a justifiable reason why LGBT patients don't always feel comfortable when they visit their straight doctor's office. New findings, I mean, gosh, isn't this it right here? New findings from research conducted by the University of Washington show that healthcare providers may in fact harbor biases against patients of opposing sexual orientations. According to the abstract, and we do want to read the full study, but according to the abstract of the study published online this week by the American Journal of Public Health, implicit preferences, this is a quote, implicit preferences for heterosexual people versus lesbian and gay people are pervasive among heterosexual healthcare providers. Wow. Straight women in the medical care field were found to have weaker implicit preferences than straight men. And among all of the surveyed healthcare professionals, straight nurses held the strongest implicit preferences for heterosexual men over gay nurses. Look at that, straight nurses holding the strongest implicit preferences for heterosexual men over gay men. The researchers looked at results from the implicit association test taken among a sample of more than 200,000 medical doctors, nurses, mental health providers, and other treatment providers, as well as non-providers from May 2006 to December 2012. So, yeah. This is kind of definitive proof right there that we need clinics, even for one day a week. If you're working at a clinic, maybe designate one afternoon a week when you're specifically going to see LGBTQ patients. Now, you need to train everybody in your clinic. You want to make sure that they know how to work with great sensitivity, as in they know the questions that they need to ask in the most appropriate way with their LGBTQ patients. Don't just put out there, hey, Thursdays, LGBTQ folks, come on over. Come on over to our clinic. No, don't do that. You got to do some training first so that it is the most safe and welcoming environment. And by the way, put that on your advertisement. Hey, we did training. That's a good thing. It's a good thing. So very exciting news that there's a clinic opening and, you know, exciting news on the research front that this is the reason why we need this. We need clinics like this. So kudos to you, University of Alabama at Birmingham, and other folks who are working at various different agencies. Have an LGBTQ day. Do some training. Do it. Now, on the transgender front, India Clark, a 25-year-old black trans woman, was found, this is terrible, it's terrible, folks, this week, just a few hours ago, was found beaten to death in the park area of Tampa, Florida's University Area Community Center. Terrible, terrible news. A park employee called police after discovering Clark's body just before 9 a.m. near the basketball courts. And this now is the 10th murder that has been reported. And those are just the ones that have been reported. The 10th trans woman murdered in 2015 in the U.S. For anybody who's saying, oh my gosh, there's, you know, we've made all these strides. There's barely any work left to do. No. Our trans brothers and sisters are actually being murdered. 10 of them. And those are just the ones reported in the U.S. in 2015. A ton of work still to do. Now, on the exciting front, and what a horrible transition. I apologize for this, because to go from the most serious to, you know, it sounds like the most superficial, but I like reporting on inroads made anywhere. Just recently, Thailand's Apple Model Management became the first agency in the world to represent transgender models in addition to its stable cisgender, non-trans male and female models. This summer, Apple Model Management LA will open its doors to exclusively represent transgender models. LA agency director Cecilio Asuncion said this, quote, "We see trans individuals as beautiful. Our strong commitment to developing them as successful models is never about quantifying or qualifying their gender. It's never a question of or if they are women or men. It's about their passion and commitment to being the best possible models they can be." I do love that story. That's a great story coming out of California. We're just going to keep going back and forth between great stories and then, oh my gosh, this really happened stories. A gay man was denied communion at his mother's funeral, but he did now receive an apology from members of the Roman Catholic hierarchy. The Reverend Mark Beard, who conducted the July 10th service, told Tim Ardillo he could not receive the sacrament because he had married outside the church, but Ardillo believes it's because he is married to a man, and this is according to the New Orleans Advocate, which is not affiliated, by the way, they want you to know, with the regular Advocate. The following Sunday at the parish, St. Helena Catholic Church in Amite, Louisiana, the congregation received a handout quoting the Bible's warning against taking communion in an unworthy manner, that is, if one has not confessed and repented of certain sins. And the Catholic Church does consider same-sex relationships sinful. Well, Ardillo, who now lives in Indiana, grew up attending St. Helena. He even served as an altar boy. Since the denial of communion, he has received apologies from the Diocese of Baton Rouge and the Archdiocese of New Orleans, the latter coming personally from Archbishop Gregory Amond. Ardillo said he still believes in Catholicism, but has drifted away from a formal relationship with the church. He had hoped the funeral would be the beginning of a renewed commitment to the church, but after the communion incident, that is no longer possible. He said this, quote, "I don't have it in me." So there you go. The refusal of communion, he noted, came as he was standing by his mother's casket with his young son, who was about to receive a blessing from Beard. If the priest had discussed the matter with him beforehand, he would not have attempted to receive communion. So that happened down in Louisiana. In New York, now in New York, nearly a month after a report critical of how New York State treats transgender and gender nonconforming students, the New York State's Education Department this week released guidelines on how school districts should accommodate them. This is great news out of education. Among the recommendations, schools should use the pronoun students prefer, use names that students prefer, keep two sets of records so birth names can be kept confidential, use sensitivity and protect students' privacy, and encourage administrators to be receptive when young people identify with and express a gender different from the one assigned at birth. Schools taking proactive policy making like this, I cannot tell you what a difference that makes, everybody. It makes such a huge difference. Our trans youth brothers and sisters, our little brothers and sisters who are in schools, who are in middle schools, who are in high schools, they report such alarming, alarming levels of bullying. But when they are in schools that have policies that proactively address safety, across the board, they report lower levels of bullying. This is not a shocker, and yet you either would be or would not be surprised. I don't know which ones for you guys, whether you're in the know or you're not, at how few schools actually take the steps to address gender identity, gender expression, and what teachers can actually do. It's not enough to just put the poster up of the eagle soaring saying respect for all. I don't know that there is such a poster, but I would assume if there is, it's got an eagle soaring. That's not enough. You actually need to concretize this. You need to tell teachers and staff, not just teachers, but also teachers and staff, hey, this is how you take this information, respect for all, and translate it into your work with youth. Not just respect for all, not just, hey, we're a safe space. Okay, what does that mean? What does that look like? Operationalize that on the day-to-day level. What does that look like for students? And the New York State Education Department, they are saying, this is what that looks like. So very great news out of New York, and we will see how this is implemented. And other states, get on it. Let's go. Do what New York is doing. Now, another big story out of the past week came out of the social media front, and it was all about Gawker. And I don't want to give too much time to Gawker. There's just a piece of this story that I would like to comment on for a second. So the editor-in-chief and the executive editor of Gawker, they both turned in letters of resignation this week protesting CEO Nick Denton's decision to remove a lurid story that outed an executive who was allegedly being extorted by a male escort and gay porn star. So if you didn't hear about this, Gawker published a horrible, horrible story, and, you know, it was the most just base story that you could put out there. They basically were supporting blackmail. And then the CEO took the story off, and then all these editorial folks said, they wrote an op-ed saying, well, we don't necessarily agree with the story, but we disagree with taking the story off. That violates our journalistic integrity. So now this week, out blogger Perez Hilton, he's saying that he believes that CEO Nick Denton made the right call. And I cringe any time I see, and this is the title Okay, this is the title of Perez Hilton. He has a whole op-ed, okay, there on The Advocate, and he said this, aspire higher. And I have such an issue, and I know that I should forgive, but it's hard for me to really forget that Perez Hilton was one of the biggest bullies out there in social media. And maybe he is using his fame now to make a difference. And I know he apologized, and he was on Ellen's show, and he's apologized, and maybe he's totally reformed. It's just, I cringe. I cringe when Perez Hilton is out there saying, aspire higher. And he said this quote, aspire higher. That's a motto I repeat daily. In the wake of the recent Gawker Media scandal, the company's founder, this is all from Perez Hilton, okay? So he said, in the wake of the recent Gawker Media scandal, the company's founder, Nick Denton, said that he wanted to raise the ethical bar for his website, and he was met with two employees quitting and several others protesting his decisions to delete the article outing a media professional, which sparked this whole controversy. There is so much here that is all sorts of wrong, but one of the things that I feel like people haven't really addressed is the disgusting elitism and snobbery of the Gawker editorial staff. He did say this. He said, quote, and I am here to challenge us to take Nick Denton at face value. Sure, he may have had ulterior motives, but people accused me of the same back in 2010 when I decided to stop outing celebrities and focus on being less of a, and I can't say that word. He said less of a, he didn't say a total one. He said, it's not easy, I make mistakes. Gawker will continue to make mistakes as well, but they are striving for better. And then he quoted Maya Angelou, and I don't know, I just can't stand Perez Hilton, and I don't know why I have all of this residual bitterness against Perez Hilton, except that I think that he really was one of the prime bullies for years, and I'm fine with him apologizing, but it annoys me that he's even commenting on this because I don't think it's a total mea culpa. So just saying that, I don't know, I'm not a big fan of Perez Hilton. Sorry, I'm not. I'm going to switch over to some global news. Some very exciting global news. The European Court of Human Rights, which is based in France, sided unanimously with six plaintiffs this week, finding Italy's lack of legal recognition and protections for same-sex couples a human rights violation. While the ruling does not compel the Italian state to extend marriage or partnership rights to same-sex couples, it adds critical pressure to the already significant calls for progress on the issue. Today, Italy is the only Italy, of all countries, Italy is the only major Western European country without any form of legal recognition for same-sex couples. Over the past few years, pressure has been mounting, and despite the relative hold the Catholic Church has over the population, recent polls have shown a growing majority support marriage equality. Faced with stagnation on the national level, a number of cities and municipalities, including Rome, Milan, and Naples, have legalized civil union registries, which offer very limited rights to couples. So some progress in Europe may be compelling Italy to make some changes. It'd be great if Italy made some changes, but some pressure. We like some pressure there. Italy, the only major Western European country without any form of legal recognition for same-sex couples. So if you're saying to yourself, hey, let's get married in Italy, and you are indeed a same-sex couple, I mean, you could do it. It probably wouldn't have any legal recognition there. So know the country that you're going to. It's important. It's important. And that, my friends, is really all the time we have left on this week's episode. Our huge, huge thanks to Ben Rimmelauer. He is doing such great work. If he's ever got a show in your area, or if you're ever in the New York City area, or you just want to watch clips of him online, you can do that. You can stroll on over to his website. We will link to it. It's right on our homepage, right there on thisshowisogay.com. If you're ever wondering, hey, what other guests have they had? You can go to thisshowisogay.com. Click on the guests tab. It's right there on top. And you can link to every interview we have ever done. Everything is there on thisshowisogay.com. I will just be a blatant tease and say we have such exciting news coming at you in about 2 to 3 weeks. We have this incredible new project that we're going to be asking your help to really get off the ground. We have spent 7 years now helping all these other projects get off the ground, and now we want to get a project off the ground. Everybody here at This Show is So Gay, and we'll be announcing that in the next couple of weeks. It's very, very exciting. You got to keep things fresh, folks. You can't just say, I'm just going to keep doing this forever, because you want to keep things fresh. You want to not have things get stagnant. So we are going to be diversifying our offerings here at This Show Is So Gay. We're excited to tell you about it. That's my tease. It's coming at you in about 3 weeks. Again, thanks to Ben Rimmelauer. Thanks to all of you who are listening. Get out there. You guys know what to do. You got to go use your voice to make a difference for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. I can't tell you how to do it. You know how to do it best. Whether you're penning an op-ed, whether you're drawing an editorial, editorial cartoon, whether you are starting up some sort of online auction, whether you are adding an LGBT day at your local clinic, whatever it might be, do what it is that you do to use your voice to make a difference. And while you are out there using your voice, while you're out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?